Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're really in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm George Scalise, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and the chair for this program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Dr. Janet Yellen, Chair of the Board of Governors of the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank. Dr. Yellen took office in 2014 for a four-year term ending in February 3, 2018. Dr. Yellen also serves as Chairman of the Federal Open Market Committee, the system's principal monetary policy-making body. Prior to her appointment as chair, Dr. Yellen served as vice chair of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. She also served as president and chief executive officer of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco from 2004 to 2010. Dr. Yellen is professor emeritus of business and economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and has been a faculty member since 1980. She was previously assistant professor at Harvard and served on the faculty of the London School of Economics. Dr. Yellen holds a PhD in economics from Yale University. Please welcome Federal Reserve Chair Dr. Janet Yellen.
Thank you. Thank you, and good afternoon. It's a pleasure to join all of you at the Commonwealth Club today, not the least because the club and the Federal Reserve have a few things in common. Both organizations, as it happens, have a board of governors and a chair. And both the club's and the Fed's histories extend back more than a century. The club, as many here know, was founded in 1903, and the Federal Reserve a decade later. Perhaps because of our shared origins in the Progressive Era, a period of reform in American life, we hold certain values in common. According to your website, the club is nonpartisan and dedicated to the impartial discussion of issues important to your community and the nation. At the Fed, we too are nonpartisan and focus squarely on the public interest. We strive to conduct our deliberations impartially and base our decisions on factual evidence and objective analysis. This afternoon, I will discuss some challenges we have faced in our recent deliberations and may face in the next few years. Perhaps, though, it's best to start by stepping back and asking what is, and importantly, what isn't, our job as the nation's central bank. And how do we go about trying to accomplish it? The Federal Reserve has an array of responsibilities. I'll mention our principal duties and then focus on one, monetary policy, the responsibility that gets the most public attention. In addition to monetary policy, we, in collaboration with other regulatory agencies at both the federal and state levels, oversee banks and some other financial institutions to ensure they operate safely and soundly and treat their customers fairly. We monitor the financial system as a whole and promote its stability to help avoid financial crises that could choke off credit to consumers and businesses. We also reliably and safely process trillions of dollars of payments for the nation's banks and the federal government, and ensure that banks have an ample supply of currency and coin to meet the demands of their depositors. And we work with communities, nonprofit organizations, lenders, educators, and others to encourage financial and economic literacy, promote equal access to credit, and advance economic and community development. But as I noted, monetary policy draws the most headlines. Well, what is monetary policy exactly? Simply put, it consists of central bank actions aimed at influencing interest rates and financial conditions more generally. Its purpose is to help foster a healthy economy. But monetary policy cannot by itself create a healthy economy. It cannot, for instance, educate young people, generate technological breakthroughs, make workers and businesses more productive, or address the root causes of inequality. Fundamentally, the energy, ingenuity, and know-how of American workers and entrepreneurs, along with our natural resources, create prosperity. Regulatory policy and fiscal policy, the decisions by the administration and Congress about how much and how the government spends taxes and borrows, can influence these more fundamental economic pillars. I've said what monetary policy cannot do, but what can it do? It can lean against damaging fluctuations in the economy. Nearly 40 years ago, the Congress set two main guideposts for that task: maximum employment and price stability. We refer to these assigned goals as our dual mandate. When the economy is weak and unemployment is on the rise, we encourage spending and investing by pushing short-term interest rates lower. As you may know, the interest rate that we target is the federal funds rate, the rate banks charge each other for overnight loans. Lowering short-term rates, in turn, puts downward pressure on longer-term interest rates, making credit more affordable for families, for instance, to buy a house, or for businesses to expand. Similarly, when the economy is threatening to push inflation too high down the road, we increase interest rates to keep the economy on a sustainable path and lean against its tendency to boom and then bust. But what exactly do the terms maximum employment and price stability mean? Does maximum employment mean that every single person who wants a job has a job? No. There are always a certain number of people who are temporarily between jobs. After having recently lost a job, or having left one voluntarily to pursue better opportunities. Others may have just graduated and have started looking for a job, or have decided to return to working, for instance, when their child starts school. This so-called frictional unemployment is evident even in the healthiest of economies. Then there's structural unemployment, a difficult problem both for the people affected and for policymakers trying to address it. Sometimes people are ready and willing to work, but their skills, perhaps because of technological advances, are not a good fit for the jobs that are available. Or suitable jobs may be available, but are not close to where they and their families live. These are factors over which monetary policy has little influence. Other measures, such as job training and other workforce development programs, are better suited to address structural unemployment. After taking account of both frictional and structural unemployment, what unemployment rate is roughly equivalent to the maximum level of employment that can be sustained in the longer run? That rate can change over time as the economy evolves, But for now, many economists, including my colleagues at the Fed and me, judge that it is around 4.75%. It's important to try to estimate the unemployment rate that is equivalent to maximum employment, because persistently operating below it pushes inflation higher, which brings me to our price stability mandate. Does price stability mean having no inflation whatsoever? Again, the answer is no. By price stability, we mean a level of inflation that's low and stable enough that it doesn't need to figure prominently into people's and businesses' economic decisions. Based on research and decades of experience, we define that level as 2% a year, an inflation objective similar to that adopted by most other major central banks. Individual prices, of course, move up and down by more than 2% all the time. Such movements are essential to a well-functioning economy. They allow supply and demand to adjust for various goods and services. By inflation, we mean price changes as a whole for all of the various goods and services that households consume. No one likes high inflation, and it's easy to understand why. Although wages and prices tend to move in tandem over long periods, inflation erodes household purchasing power if it's not matched with similar increase in wages, and it eats away the value of household savings. So then, why don't we and other central banks aim for zero inflation? There are several technical reasons, but a more fundamental reason is to create a buffer against the opposite of inflation, that is, deflation. Deflation is a general and persistent decline in the level of prices, a phenomenon Americans last experienced during the Great Depression of the 1930s, and one that Japan has confronted for most of the past two decades. Deflation can feed on itself, leading to economic stagnation or worse. It puts pressure on employers to either cut wages or cut jobs. And it can be very hard on borrowers who find themselves repaying their loans with dollars that are worth more than the dollars they originally borrowed. I'm sure we all remember learning in school about farm families in the Great Depression who couldn't pay their mortgages and lost their homes and livelihoods when crop prices fell persistently. Another important reason to maintain a modest inflation buffer is that too low inflation impairs the ability of monetary policy to counter economic downturns. When inflation is very low, interest rates tend to be very low also, even in good times. And when interest rates are generally very low, the Fed has only limited room to cut them to help the economy in bad times. In a nutshell, the Fed's goal is to promote financial conditions conducive to maximum employment and price stability, and I've offered broad brush definitions of each of these objectives. So where is the economy now in relationship to them? The short answer is, we think it's close. The economy's come a long way since the financial crisis. As you know, the crisis marked the start of a very deep recession. It destroyed nearly 9 million jobs, and it's been a long, slow slog to recover from it. Unemployment peaked at 10% late in 2009, a level unseen for more than 25 years, and didn't move below 8% for nearly 3 years. Falling home prices put millions of homeowners underwater, meaning they owed more on their mortgages than their homes were worth. And the stock market plunged, slashing the value of 401k retirement nest eggs. The extraordinarily severe recession required an extraordinary response from monetary policy, both to support the job market and prevent deflation. We cut our short-term interest rate target to near zero at the end of 2008 and kept it there for 7 years. To provide further support to American households and businesses, we pressed down on longer-term interest rates by purchasing large amounts of longer-term Treasury securities and government-guaranteed mortgage securities. And we communicated our intent to keep short-term interest rates low for a long time, thus increasing the downward pressure on longer-term interest rates, which are influenced by expectations about short-term rates. Now, it's fair to say the economy is near maximum employment and inflation is moving toward our goal. The unemployment rate is less than 5%, roughly back to where it was before the recession. And over the past 7 years, the economy has added about 15.5 million net new jobs. Although inflation has been running below our 2% objective for quite some time, we've seen it start inching back toward 2% last year as the job market continued to improve and as the effects of a big drop in oil prices faded. Last month, at our most recent meeting, we took account of the considerable progress the economy has made by modestly increasing our short-term interest rate target by 0.25 percentage point to a range of 0.5 to 0.75%. It was the second such step, the first came a year earlier, and reflects our confidence the economy will continue to improve. Now, many of you would love to know exactly when the next rate increase is coming and how high rates will rise. The simple truth is, I can't tell you, because it will depend on how the economy actually evolves over coming months. The economy is vast and vastly complex, and its path can take surprising twists and turns. What I can tell you is what we expect, along with the very large caveat that our interest rate expectations will change as our outlook for the economy changes. That said, as of last month, I and most of my colleagues, the other members of the Fed Board in Washington, and the presidents of the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks were expecting to increase our federal funds rate target a few times a year until, by the end of 2019, it is close to our estimate of its longer-run neutral rate of 3%. The term neutral rate requires some explaining. It's the rate that, once the economy has reached our objectives, will keep the economy on an even keel. It's neither pressing on the gas pedal to make the car go faster, nor easing off so much that the car slows down. Right now, our foot is still pressing on the gas pedal, though, as I noted, we have eased back a bit. Our foot remains on the pedal in part because we want to make sure the economic expansion remains strong enough to withstand an unexpected shock, given that we don't have much room to cut interest rates. In addition, inflation is still running below our 2% objective, and by some measures, there may still be some room for progress in the job market. For instance, wage growth has only recently begun to pick up and remains fairly low. And a broader measure of unemployment isn't quite back to its pre-recession level. It includes people who would like a job but have been too discouraged to look for one, and people who are working part-time but would rather work full-time. Nevertheless, as the economy approaches our objectives, it makes sense to gradually reduce the level of monetary policy support. Changes in monetary policy take time to work their way into the economy. Waiting too long to begin moving toward the neutral rate could risk a nasty surprise down the road, either too much inflation, financial instability, or both. In that scenario, we could be forced to raise interest rates rapidly, which in turn could push the economy into a new recession. The factors I've just discussed are the usual sort that central bankers consider as economies move through a recovery. But a longer-term trend, slow productivity growth, helps explain why we don't think dramatic interest rate increases are required to move our federal funds rate target back to neutral. Labor productivity, that is, the output of goods and services per hour of work, has increased by only about 0.5% a year on average over the past 6 years or so, and only 1.25% a year over the past decade. That contrasts with the previous 30 years when productivity grew a bit more than 2% a year. This productivity slowdown matters enormously because American standard of living depends on productivity growth. With productivity growth of 2% a year, the average standard of living will double roughly every 35 years. That means our children can reasonably hope to be better off economically than we are now. But productivity growth of 1% a year means the average standard of living will double only every 70 years. Economists do not fully understand the causes of the productivity slowdown. Some emphasize that technological progress and its diffusion throughout the economy seem to be slower over the past decade or so. Others look at college graduation rates, which have flattened out after rising rapidly in previous generations. And still others focus on a dramatic slowing in the creation of new businesses, which are often more innovative than established firms. While each of these factors has likely played a role in slowing productivity growth, the extent to which they will continue to do so is an open question. Why does slow productivity growth, if it persists, imply a lower neutral interest rate? First, it implies that the economy's usual rate of output growth, when employment is at its maximum and prices are stable, will be significantly slower than the post-World War II average. Slower economic growth, in turn, implies businesses will see less need to invest in expansion. And it implies families and individuals will feel the need to save more and spend less. Because interest rates are the mechanism that brings the supply of savings and demand for investment funds into balance, more saving and less investment imply a lower neutral interest rate. Although we can't directly measure the neutral interest rate, it's something that can be estimated in retrospect, and as we have increasingly realized, it has probably been trending down for a while now. Our current 3% estimate of the longer-run neutral rate, for instance, is a full percentage point lower than our estimate just 3 years ago. You might be thinking, what does this discussion of rather esoteric concepts such as the neutral rate mean to me? If you're a borrower, it means that although the interest rates you pay on, say, your auto loan or mortgage or credit card likely will creep higher, they probably will not increase dramatically. Likewise, if you're a saver, the rate you earn could inch higher after a while, but probably not by a lot. For some years, I've heard from savers who want higher rates. Now I'm beginning to hear from borrowers who want lower rates. I can't emphasize strongly enough, though, that we are not trying to help one of those groups at the expense of the other. We're focused very much on that dual mandate I keep mentioning. At the end of the day, we all benefit from plentiful jobs and stable prices, whether we're savers or borrowers, and many of us, of course, are both. Economics and monetary policy are at best inexact sciences. Figuring out what the neutral interest rate is and setting the right path toward it is not like setting the thermostat of a house. You can't just set the temperature at 68 degrees and walk away. And because changes in monetary policy affect the economy with long lags sometimes, we must base our decisions on our best forecast of an uncertain future. Thus, we must continually reassess and adjust our policies based on what we learn. That point leads me to repeat what I said when I began. Like the Commonwealth Club, the Federal Reserve was created more than a century ago during an era of government reform to serve the public interest. The structure established for the Federal Reserve back then intentionally insulates us from short-term political pressures so we can focus on what's best for the American economy in the longer run. I promise you, with the sometimes imperfect information and evidence we have available, we will do just that by making the best decisions we can as objectively as we can. Thank you, and I would now welcome your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Yellen. And welcome to all of you on this soggy day, this magnificent venue. I'm Ed Wasserman, Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. It's my proud duty to convey the questions that I've been handed that you have composed. The idea of posing questions that one is given from unidentified shadowy masters seems to exemplify what the president-elect thinks that reporters do. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's a great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
I want to, in some of your earlier talks over the past year, you identified not just productivity but inequality as among your major concerns in guiding the Fed. And I'm wondering, what might we look for as interested and somewhat knowledgeable outsiders in Fed actions that would reflect this concern for inequality?
Well, the tools that the Federal Reserve has to address very disturbing trends pertaining to inequality are limited. Some important causes, at least in my view, and I think that of many economists, factors that have given rise to inequality, we see a growing differential in the wages earned by those who are more skilled with more education and the incomes of those with less education. And when we ask what forces are responsible for that, technological change that has increased the demand for skill and advantaged those who have the ability to work with technology and globalization, those are certainly two important factors. And these are trends that we can't directly affect. But by attaining maximum employment, which is the goal assigned to us by Congress, we make sure that there are abundant job opportunities. And I think it's evident that when there's a great deal of slack in the labor market, as there was after the financial crisis for many years, well, that's something that harms everyone. Minority groups and those with less skill tend to experience the most dramatic declines in their income and increases in their unemployment rates. And when the economy generally recovers and unemployment comes down, those groups that normally have higher unemployment rates actually see the biggest declines in their unemployment rates and gains in their income. So maintaining a healthy economy with low unemployment is something that, relative to slack labor market conditions, is something that greatly benefits minority groups and others who are less advantaged in the labor market. So that is one important way in which we can help.
There's a concern, and perhaps reflected in the demographics of this group today, there's a great concern about the baby boom generation reaching retirement with a sort of gross deficiency of assets. And I wonder, it's obviously going to have some impact on future consumer spending levels. It's going to have, you know, disruptive impacts in men that'll ripple through the society. And I'm wondering, how does that concern enter into the kind of decisions that you and your colleagues have to make? How does that mediate through in the world to the world of monetary policy?
So I think the aging of the American population, the retirement of the baby boomers, is one of the most important trends that is going to be affecting and already is affecting our economy. One way in which we're already seeing the impact is that the rate of labor force participation, the fraction of the population participating in the labor market, has fallen substantially and is expected, because of demographics, to continue declining. We're also seeing slow growth in the labor force, which is pushing down estimates of the rate at which the economy is capable of growing over the medium and longer term. My colleagues, for example, now estimate that the longer-run normal real growth rate of the economy is probably going to decline to slightly under 2%, which is low by historical standards. Of course, the aging of the population makes a great deal to patterns of spending and is an important reason why we should expect the healthcare sector to be expanding as retirees obviously consume substantially more healthcare than other elements in the population. And as you mentioned, retirement savings is, of course, an important issue. And regrettably, I think research shows that many American families are not well prepared for retirement and will continue to be a disproportionate share of families heavily reliant on Social Security as their primary source of income.
I'm being overwhelmed here with learned questions that rest on facts, not in evidence. Bear with me a moment. I would like to draw you out a little bit on an area of policy that's clearly not within the Fed's bailiwick, but may impact the world that you have to deal with, and this has to do with trade. And particularly, there's been in a way that's probably not been seen in recent elections, certainly in my lifetime, trade was a major campaign issue, or at least a campaign slogan or set of slogans. I'm wondering how although you don't handle trade, you do handle the dollar, you handle dollar, and exchange rates impact your world a lot. And the dollar is very strong right now. I think the pound was $1.24 yesterday, which is very unprecedented. And I'm wondering if the continuance of policies to have the effect of forcing the dollar upward further, how does that begin to ripple through into your world, and what should we be looking for?
Well, the value of the dollar is an important influence on the economy, and it's one of the factors that determines the magnitude of a country's trade deficit. So the Fed does pay attention to the value of the dollar when we try to forecast the economy, although we don't in any sense target the economy. Our objective is, as I emphasized in my remarks, to try to achieve maximum employment and price stability, but we take it into account. Now, one of the factors that influences the value of the dollar is divergences in interest rates across countries, which in turn partly reflect different paths for monetary policy and the underlying strength of one economy versus another. So you referred to the substantial run-up we've seen in the dollar over the last couple of years. The U.S. economy has enjoyed a stronger and faster recovery than many of our trading partners, advanced nations, and a consequence of that is U.S. monetary policy has begun to tighten slightly, and it's expected, as I mentioned, that we'll stay on a gradual path of rate increases, and that expectation in the market of growing divergences between U.S. and foreign interest rates is, plus the underlying strength of the economy, is something that has put upward pressure on the dollar. And when the dollar strengthens, that tends to make U.S. goods less competitive in global markets, to diminish exports and to make imports cheaper, raising imports. And so net exports and imports have been a drag for a couple of years now on the U.S. economy, and expect that drag to continue. In recent months, we've seen some further appreciation of the dollar. In part, that likely reflects market expectations that growth will strengthen, perhaps due to expansionary fiscal policies, and that has been reflected in the dollar. So trade policies can directly impact a country's trade deficit and trade position, but there are other factors also that need to be taken into account when one contemplates the evolution of a country's trade deficit, and the dollar is an important factor as a economic growth here and abroad.
Well, let me ask you about another area of impact on rising rates, and that would have to do with equities valuations. You had made some statements in the last year expressing some, I don't think you used the B word, I don't think you were suggesting that the equities are in a bubble. We're very sensitive to that here in the Bay Area, as you know, because we're very fond of our bubbles and we love our tech sector. So I'm wondering whether the raising rates is pushing people out of bonds into equities, is that going to, do you have any concern, or what would you be looking for to, in terms of equity multiples or valuations, that you would begin to actually get worried enough about to have it influence policy?
So I try not to give investment advice or to comment on what the right what the right values for asset prices are, unless I am very concerned about a real risk to financial stability that asset prices might entail. At the moment, I would regard risk to financial stability. They're always present to some extent, but I would regard them as moderate. One indication of financial stability risks would be growing leverage. Leverage is not at excessive levels or very rapid credit growth, and we're seeing credit growth, but not at a pace that would give me great concern about financial stability. Banks are strong. They have a great deal more capital and liquidity than prior to the crisis, and the Federal Reserve engages in regular stress testing of the portfolios of major financial institutions to make sure that they could suffer a very serious adverse shock and go on meeting the credit needs of our economy. So I really would characterize financial stability risks as moderate. But coming back to the stock market, the level of interest rates is one of the influences on asset valuations, generally, including equity prices. And we've had, as I mentioned, generally low interest rates. Markets are anticipating. We've indicated our expectation is for gradual increases in interest rates over the next several years in short rates. That type of expectation is embodied in longer-term interest rates in the market. And that level and set of expectations about interest rates, I believe, is an influence and partly explains why price-equity ratios are as high as they are, namely rates of return on stock are determined by market participants partly relative to what they can earn on bonds. And that differential is normal in the historical sense, but interest rates do matter. And I do think it's important that investors take into account, I mentioned uncertainty. Life can often take, the economy can take twists and turns that are unexpected, and movements in interest rates up or down that are large and not anticipated by the markets could affect those valuations.
I have several interesting questions here about technology, and let me put them before you and pick the ones you like. But there's a question here about in light of the experience with hacking, how zealously the Fed guards its own data from outside manipulation, and how real is the risk of manipulation of that data. And then there's a question here also about increased demand, decreased demand for paper money, the economic consequences of a cashless economy, how might it affect the Fed, and similarly a question of will the government start a blockchain currency-free system such as FedCoin? And this interlocutor says, you're quoted as saying we're looking into it. Is that a correct quote? The way you fend off questions when you...
I'm not positive if I've said that or not, okay. But blockchain is an important technology.
Does everybody know what is blockchain?
It's a technology that's actually embodied. It's a core technology that was incorporated in Bitcoin. And while I do not regard myself as expert on this, my understanding is that this is a technology that enables transactions and ownership of things to be taken care of automatically without a need, for example, for a trusted central party to record transactions. So it is a very important new technology that could have implications for the way in which transactions are handled throughout the financial system. We are looking at it in terms of its promise in some of the technologies that we use ourselves, and many financial institutions are looking at it. It could make a big difference to the way in which transactions are cleared and settled in the global economy. But so that's on blockchain. You asked about cybersecurity and the security of our own systems. And of course, cybersecurity is a very prominent threat. We recognize that, and we are working very hard to protect our core systems, for example, Fedwire and other core systems that we have that process trillions of dollars of transactions. We apply the highest security standards and fight to stay ahead of the curve to the maximum extent possible.
Have you had instances that gave you pause?
We have never suffered a major breach. Our public-facing websites have had some incidents, but nothing. We've never experienced anything that has affected a core Federal Reserve system, and we do what we can to make sure it stays that way. We're also working closely with financial institutions and key utilities that operate in the payment system to try to make sure that our financial system as a whole is secure and that we can address cybersecurity threats that could filter through the system. This is a very high priority for us. Let me see, you asked, was there another piece of that question that you also mentioned that you would like me to address?
I don't remember.
Okay, so I'll quit there then.
I had aggregated these, cashless economy.
Cashless economy. So there are, we're not there yet. I believe that the demand and use of cash continues to increase. But there are many important innovations taking place in the payment space, fintech innovations that I think are very exciting in terms of resulting in faster, safer payments, not only at the wholesale but also at the retail level, that could change the use of cash over time. And I would just say for our part in the Federal Reserve System, we're monitoring those developments very carefully. We want to make sure that useful and welfare-enhancing innovations can take place and that we don't stifle them. And yet we also want to make sure that consumers are well protected.
I want to draw you out a little bit on banking regulation. The banks came out of the 2008-09 meltdown with their reputations somewhat tainted. And there's obviously concern about the adequacy of regulation and oversight. I have a question here about quantitative easing. Why was so much of the money provided to the banks remaining in their vaults unspent? There's a question about, well, if Dodd-Frank is dismantled, what sort of pressure would that put on the Fed? What sort of functions would it have to assume? And I think there's a general sense, I think, from several of these questions of mistrust in the competence and the motives. And we've had these scandals involving Wells Fargo and cross-selling of products where sort of essentially fraudulent activities. And I'm wondering about if you could talk a little bit about the Fed's role in regulating banking and whether it is, are you facing greater challenges now than you've been at the Fed a long time?
Yes.
Is it getting harder now, and do you have the tools you need?
So we have greatly strengthened our supervision and regulation of the banking system in the aftermath of the financial crisis and put in place particularly high and demanding standards for the largest and the most systemic institutions. We have greatly increased the amount of capital, the quantity and quality of capital that we expect those institutions to hold. We have greatly increased the amount of liquidity that we expect them to hold, and the way in which we've supervised them, and in particular, every year we subject the largest, most systemic institutions to a detailed stress test in which Federal Reserve analysts take their portfolios and we spell out a severely adverse scenario, a scenario in which the economy is going to be hit by a very sharp downturn, possibly with important prices like commercial real estate prices or house prices falling substantially, developments that would impose losses on these institutions. And we carefully evaluate what losses they would suffer and what their capital would be in the event of such a severe shock. And we insist, we review their capital plans, and we insist that they maintain enough capital to be able to be, to serve the credit needs of the U.S. economy even after such a severe shock. That is a very demanding exercise, and we insist that they be able to analyze themselves the impact of such shocks, that they have risk management abilities that are up to the standards that we should expect given their importance in the economy. We have been putting in place policies to deal with the so-called too-big-to-fail problem, that we would want it to be the case that if a significant institution were to encounter difficulties, that that institution could be resolved without the U.S. taxpayers having to come in and provide funds. And I would say that we've made significant progress. We've forced the largest institutions to prepare so-called living wills that would show, if they were to encounter severe stress, how they could be resolved either in bankruptcy or through a new orderly liquidation process that's incorporated in Dodd-Frank. And having to prepare those living wills has forced firms to really simplify, to think more carefully about the way in which they're structured, how they manage liquidity, and to prepare themselves for a stressful situation. So I would say our supervision has changed substantially. The regulations that Dodd-Frank put in effect have provided a fantastic set of guidelines for us as we've strengthened supervision, and I do think that we have a much safer and sounder financial system. That said, you mentioned abuses, and there still are abuses, and the level of compliance with laws that we see in some important financial institutions. You mentioned the customer abuses at Wells Fargo. We have seen institutions penalized for violating U.S. sanctions, for violations of the Bank Secrecy Act, for LIBOR and foreign exchange scandals, and this remains conduct that really I regard as unacceptable, and we want to see definitely improve compliance, and we're focused on that.
You will recall, I just wonder whether scale, it sometimes occurs to you that scale is the enemy, and that do you ever look wistfully back at the time before the banks went national, when Bank of America lived in California and Chase lived in New York, and do you ever think we might have erred in creating these national giants?
The financial crisis did. We were getting giant firms prior to the financial crisis, and the financial crisis probably caused there to be greater concentration in banking. In some ways, I think that is an adverse development, although, you know, it's something that was understandable given the strains. We still have a very large number of community banks that serve the needs of their communities and engage in innovative lending practices and understand their communities and bring a diverse set of banking services, make them available to consumers. So although we do have greater concentration, we also have many sources of diversity in terms of what's available to businesses and households.
There's a question here, perhaps less about you than about your office, about your or the Fed chair's relationship with presidents. And it isn't, this is not a forward-looking question. This is a historical question. But how do you, I mean, how does one, how do you communicate? You're statutorily, you're sort of, you know, by code, by honor, by law, you know, supposed to be, you know, rigorously independent, and yet you inhabit the same policy universe.
We do.
What the president thinks is not immaterial to your thinking. You communicate through code. I mean, how do you, how do they make known their expectations, and how do you make known your response?
Well, for example, a very long tradition dating back many decades is that the Fed chair and the Treasury secretary regularly meet and discuss the economy and a range of issues where we have common responsibilities. I'm not sure when this practice began, but it is many decades old. And so during my term as chair, I've had virtually a weekly breakfast or lunch with Jack Lew, who's Treasury Secretary.
And your thinking is this is the way you basically keep abreast of what the administration's thinking is. He's the conduit for that.
Well, we share a common interest in the success of the U.S. economy. And the administration, at least the ones that I've had any direct experience with, have definitely respected the independence of the Fed. I have never had a situation where a member of the administration has tried in any way to pressure me for any reason about the stance of monetary policy. I think it is appropriate for me to explain to the public, as I've tried to do today and do regularly, the logic behind monetary policy, how we see the economy, why we may have taken actions that we did, and I would do that with the administration just as I would with the public. We would share information about economic developments and our interpretation of those. On financial regulation, we cooperate, and so independence really is something that refers to monetary policy. But, for example, the Treasury Secretary chairs a group called the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is a large group of regulators that are focused on potential threats to financial stability. And we would discuss those threats and appropriate actions of the council. We jointly represent the United States in many international fora, and sit next to one another routinely at meetings of groupings like the G20 or G7. So we share a responsibility for the economy and discuss it and make sure that we're exchanging information.
I have a thoughtful question here that about uncertainties. And there does seem to, you know, when you read the news sort of dwells in the world of uncertainties and hectoring, you know, hazarding guesses as to the way things might be developing. I wonder, though, it does seem an unusually turbulent moment. The presidency beginning with a lot of ambiguity as far as policy directions, Brexit, the European Union, NATO's, and I'm wondering, when you survey the environment out there, what are the, I don't want to say trouble spots, but what are the things that come to you and say, aha, that is something we really have to track carefully? What would be the top three or four things that you really want to keep a very close eye on, because it's going to affect your world in a major way?
So you listed many of the things that we are focused on. I would say that although there are many uncertainties now, for example, in our most recent statement of the Federal Open Market Committee, we described the risks to the near-term outlook as generally balanced. So while, of course, there are uncertainties, I think my assessment at this point is that some of the global uncertainties that we focus on are a little bit less worrisome than they have been in recent years. But, of course, we are very much focused on global growth. Global growth has been relatively weak, and we carefully track developments in major parts of the global economy. China plays a very important role, and Chinese growth has been slowing. That's not an unexpected development. It's something that we have long anticipated, but China plays a very important role in the global economy, and so we track those developments quite carefully. Obviously, commodity markets can be a source of volatility and have economic impacts, and we've seen substantial fluctuations in energy and other commodity prices, and we watch that carefully. And of course, economic policy does make a difference, and we are at a point when many economic policy changes are under consideration, and of course, we will closely follow what happens with economic policy and take any changes that occur. We will factor those into the outlook and take account of their impact on what we need to do to achieve our dual mandate objectives. So those are very important uncertainties.
I have some questions here. I believe we have some students in the audience, and they're sort of on the personal level. First is, what advice that you would give to recent college graduates in the world of work, business, and public service? And another it asks you, if you could go back in time and speak to yourself at the beginning of your career, what advice would you give yourself? And sort of an allied question is about the condition of the opportunities that women have now in the financial sector. And is there any, have you any observations you want to share about the particular opportunities and challenges that women face?
So with respect to recent college graduates, I think you're entering a very strong job market. Opportunities, I think, are plentiful, but we live in a world where technology and skill needs for the labor market change over time, and lifelong learning and always updating one's skills and recognizing that you may need to learn things in the future in order to have successful careers, that your learning shouldn't end when you get your sheepskin. So, let's see, opportunities for women. I think opportunities for women have generally improved, but I will say that in many of the meetings that I go to in the economics profession generally, and among college majors. Women are underrepresented in economics, business, and finance. And
did you feel at times personally disadvantaged by being a woman?
I haven't felt personally disadvantaged by being a woman, but there were relatively few women. For example, when I was in graduate school or served on faculties. And I think what research has shown is that the absence or shortage of role models does have an impact on women's interest in pursuing a particular field. And in that sense, I think that women are somewhat disadvantaged. That may be one reason that there are relatively few college majors in economics. Only about 30% of econ majors in college are women. And that's surprising given that the STEM fields generally do not have an underrepresentation of women, and mathematics doesn't have an underrepresentation of women. So the kinds of things, well, maybe women like math less than men, that really doesn't seem to be what's going on. So I think we're not certain what the causes are, and it's certainly something that I would like to see changed over time. We are very focused on diversity of all sorts in the Fed, in our hiring, and in the work we do. We really want to see women and minorities succeed.
I guess that other question in there was, what advice would you give yourself now if you were starting out?
Well, I think I got good advice. I was pleased I majored in economics. I feel I've had a very good career and gotten... I really don't have a lot of regrets, so.
Fantastic. I think we're at the end of our session, yes? So I want to thank Madam Chair, Janet Yellen. Thank you so much. I want to thank all of you for coming out on this damp day. And it's my proud duty to declare this session over.
Thank you.